Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
But after that, we got worked super hard. And it's kind of like strength through adversity. Once you've been through something really grim, you've got the confidence of knowing, you know, I can do this. And then that kind of releases you.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Jason Pickles. Jason is a proper underdog and a climber's climber. I don't know Jace very well, but we have worked together a few times overseas and we spent a bit of time together partying slightly too hard at mountain festivals and weddings. We have a lot of close mutual friends, the most well-known of whom is Leo Holding, who in many ways has defined a lot of what we've both achieved over the course of our adult lives. Jace and Leo are best friends and have spent a lot of time climbing all over the world together. Jace is proudly Northern and grew up climbing in Lancashire, Yorkshire and Cumbria before the climbing scene really exploded and turned into what it is now. In this episode, we explore Jace's life as a climber, how he went from a young weekend warrior to a full-time talented dirt bagger, and then into detail on how he became such a crucial part of one of the most elite and successful expedition climbing teams of the modern era. In this episode, we speak a lot about their first major expedition together to climb Mount Asgard on Baffin Island in 2009. We speak about ego and imposter syndrome, and how he's more than comfortable being surrounded by people who are better at their sport than him. We look a little bit at machismo and what it was like growing up surrounded by hardy, older northern men who saw a rough and tumble approach to teaching a kid as the right thing to do. We also look really closely at the transition from full-time life a climber to stay-at-home dad and the realities of this new life that Jace has built for himself. Towards the end of the episode, Jace alludes to an experience he had in South America whilst on expedition where he took Yopo, an indigenous medicine that's highly psychedelic and hallucinogenic that had a profound effect on him. But that whole ordeal is a story for another day. All in all, this is an honest, open conversation with a man who knows exactly who he is, who he isn't, and what he wants from life. Before we begin, I'd like to talk to you about Sidetracked magazine, our sister publication. Sidetracked is an incredible quarterly journal that celebrates authentic stories of adventure and exploration. You can find out more at sidetracked.com. I'd also like to take a quick moment to push you in the direction of our charitable partner, the Martin Moran Foundation. They're a wonderful organization working to get young people from disadvantaged backgrounds into the outdoors. You can find information about how you can support them on our Instagram bio at The Adventure Podcast. Finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do subscribe on iTunes and leave us an honest review. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience. Okay, over to Jason Pickles.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's start at the start. Tell me who you are and what you do.
Who am I? That's a bit deep, isn't it? I am a climber. I'm a husband. I'm a father. And I'm a friend. And yeah, I think defines me. I always will identify as a climber, even when I don't climb, even when I can't climb anymore. It's integral to who I am, I think.
Okay, Ace, so let's go back to the start of that. When did you start climbing and become a climber? I guess they're maybe two different questions.
Yeah, I started climbing when I was about 16. Before that, I played a lot of football, a lot of cricket. Grew up in a small northern town. Got up to no good, like everybody does. And then I had an uncle who worked for the fire brigade, and his watch, I think it was like Blue Watch, Halifax Fire Station, they used to do these annual trips where they went and did stuff. And I went on one of those when I was 16. And I went on it primarily because it meant I could get pissed. And we did some walking. We walked up Blencathra, and we did some climbing. We climbed at Shepherd's Crag. And that kind of started it. And then my other uncle, he climbed a little bit. So I started going with him. And after not very long, I kind of stopped playing football and cricket because I wanted to go climbing at the weekend. And if it was raining on one day, I wanted to go climbing on the other day. And if I had to play football, that meant I couldn't do that. So kind of quickly, everything else fell away and I just wanted to go climbing. And I wasn't particularly good. I spent a long time puntering around, climbing VS, hard VS for a couple of years. But I think really early on, I was obsessed with it. It got me. So, you know, from even when I was not very good, I would have called myself a climber, I think.
And what was it, do you think, that gripped you so early on with it?
I don't know. I always spent a lot of time outside. So I was kind of into being outside. I was into sport. I kind of liked the physical side of it. I think the mental side of it was new to me, but I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed not knowing, being a bit scared. Like, I enjoyed the jeopardy. Like, you know, am I going to get up there? Am I going to be able to do it? Where are we going? Going to new places. Yeah, I think that. And the crack, I enjoyed, like, I used to go with my uncle and a lot of guys who were a lot older, and they were like, I don't know, old school characters. There was one of his friends who he used to make me, like, I used to have to wrestle him for my breakfast and stuff. He'd be like, right, Jake, hungry, are you? Well, you can't have your breakfast until we've had a wrestle. And he'd batter me, basically. And, you know, in a good way, but in an old school kind of, it was very much, I think the old kind of apprenticeship, rock climbing apprenticeship was great. And I liked it. I liked the banter. I liked, you know, them giving me shit, me giving them shit. Yeah, I just like the whole thing.
When are we talking?
So I was 16, so like 1991.
Okay. And climbing's changed a lot since then.
Climbing has changed a lot since then, yeah. Like, you know, everything's changed a lot since then, hasn't it? I think I'm characters. I'm drawn to characters and... Yeah, I don't know whether I'm drawn to him or whether, I don't know, but there's always been lots of characters in my life in lots of different ways. And people like Chris that I had to wrestle, you know, were character, and I love that. you know, and good points and bad points. You know, Chris was a bit of a, in my hometown, he was a bit of a hard man. He had a bit of a reputation. He was amazing with me, you know, but he'd give me a hard time at times. But I love all that shit. And there's not enough of it anymore. I don't think, you know, I'm going to sound like a dinosaur, but that stuff was really formative for me. It really, really made a big difference to me. And it was really of value rather than, you know, I didn't feel all oppressed and picked on or, you know, it was something that made me grow.
I think you've sort of answered it, but I was going to say, do you look back on that wholly positively?
Completely. 100, like, I don't, yeah, like, 100%, yeah. And it never was in, like, there was never any kind of malice in any way, shape, or form. Chris is a lovely guy, you know, and I still know him and I still see him on occasion. It was just kind of how things were in northern towns then, and a little bit of, like, making people, giving them a bit of shit and making them work for your respect or whatever was just a normal thing. And yeah, it was a massively positive thing for me and not bad in any way, shape or form.
But you know, you're saying you're 16, so it's like an incredibly formative time for anyone at that age. And you said in your intro, which is quite rare, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people for this podcast, you said friend. When I said, who are you? You said, I'm a friend. That seems quite important to you. How much when you found climbing, obviously you had a community through football and stuff like that, but how much did you find a community as opposed to just vertical climbing?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, like I'm still friends with everybody that I grew up with. I still spend a lot of time with my friends and I've got loads of amazing friends through climbing, but I didn't, you know, in climbing, a lot of people kind of leave their old lives behind and it's like a new, it's like a reinvention or, you know, whatever. And don't get me wrong, I'm kind of a different person to my friends back home than I am in climbing. But friends are, yeah, like I think they should be really important to everybody, shouldn't they? It's not, you know, like it's your friends that essentially make you who you are and kind of validate who you are and, you know, reinforce the things that are important to you, I think.
Yeah, I'd buy that. So you're 16, you're climbing at the weekends. Are you at school? Have you left school? What was life like?
At school, did A-levels. School was like GCSEs, it was kind of easy, but I didn't really apply myself very well. I don't have a huge drive to, you know. So GCSEs were fine, whereas A-levels, when you start to have to do some work and have to, you know, then I didn't do as well, whereas I just coasted through GCSEs. But yeah, no, total weekend warrior, basically. And then went to shit unit to kind of just give me more time to climb in a way, just kick the can down the road. Like, you know, people are like, you know, I had mates who knew what they wanted to do. I was like, I haven't got a clue what I want to do, but I, you know, I definitely know that I want to go climbing a bit more. So in a lot of ways, going to college, uni was just a way of prolonging that. And then I just got more and more. That meant I had more time to go climbing. So I climbed more and it just kind of snowballed into, yeah, an obsession, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's probably worth saying, like, for you and the people who are going to listen to this, like, we know each other, but not very well. So I don't know the answer to any of what I'm about to ask
you. Yeah.
What did you then do? Like, did you have a plan to get a career or?
No. I've never had a plan. I don't, like, that's, you know, I'm not, in some ways, one of my superpowers is not worrying about anything because I don't look to the future particularly. It's, you've just got to deal with what's in front of you. There's no point worrying about what's coming up. And, you know, sometimes it's frustrating. Probably, it's probably frustrating for my wife sometimes that I don't have more of a plan or, but I just go with what, you know, I just kind of drifted, in a way, just drifted. I just wanted to go climbing. So that's what I did. And then that led to various opportunities. And, you know, I never had a plan that I was going to never get a real job or, you know, spend my life messing around with my mates. But that's kind of what happened. So it worked out pretty well, you know. But no, I never had like, no, I was never ever bothered about going here or doing this. It was just about, right, you know, get up, is it fine, go climbing. Kind of, you know, and like if somebody said, do you want to do this? Well, either say yes or no. And invariably I'd say yes. The other thing, I'm not very good at saying no to anything. Which has served me quite well, I think. You know, like, regret doing it, don't regret not doing it, yeah, has been one of my mottos, I suppose.
I envy the not worrying thing or the no plan thing.
Yeah, yeah, you're obviously a worrier. You know, my wife's a worrier. She stresses about things. And my oldest kid, he thinks about stuff. Yeah, I don't. Sometimes I wish I did a little bit more. But sometimes I'm just, you know, you've got no control. You just deal with what's happening, and if you do that, it's all good.
Well, the grass is greener, isn't it? Because I'm sat here going, oh my God, that sounds so peaceful. Like, what's that like to just not have the thoughts worrying all the time?
I don't know any different. So yeah, probably like, yeah, my brain is not going at 1,000 miles an hour thinking about stuff ever, real life. I get it off my dad's like super, if he was any more laid back, he'd be asleep. Like he's just super chill, which I'm obviously a little bit like him in that way. And, you know, it's good. It's good on trips. It works really well on expeditions in lots of ways. It's good. It depends. There's hierarchies, and then when you go away on a trip, there's like a, and I'm just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And
yeah, we'll come on to that. I'm really fascinated to go into all that. Yeah, I'll save it for a minute. Let's get there. But so you did uni, and obviously the climbing was picking up a pace. There are some obvious trigger points that we're clearly going to get to, like meeting Leo seems like a massive one. But you must have got good at some point, and you must have earned money at some point.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I blew uni. Like, it's one of the... I don't regret a lot of things, but, if I'd put a little bit more effort in, I would have got something out of it, whereas as all I got out of it was like lots of partying, some debt, and 4 years to kind of go climbing. But through all that, I was just into it. You know, like I think the whole thing, I don't know when it didn't matter to me that whether I was good or not. And I think that's kind of one of the points where you start to get good. And yeah, there was like a good scene in like Lancashire/Yorkshire and loads of old school characters again. People like Jerry Peel, Mick Johnston, old school climbers. And there was just like a bit of a scene, and I kind of got involved with that a little bit. And they used to like have the crack with me at the wall. And I was like the young youth jumping around. Yeah, I suppose I started to get good. And then I think I had friends who were just as good, but didn't have, I say I didn't have any drive, but didn't have any drive to push themselves. So I was like, right, well, I've done an E3, so I want to do an E4. Whereas lots of mates were like, well, I've done an E3, I'll just cruise around at E3. Whereas I kind of had this urge to like, right, well, I've done that, so I'll try something harder. So started to get all right, started to meet people, climbed quite a lot with John Dunn, who is like a big, again, another character of British climbing. He was amazing. Like, it was so much fun. He was, I just got really into climbing and kind of headpointing. John at the time was headpointing lots of things and everything was just like a laugh. We just went out and I started to get things done and get to know people a little bit. And then I kind of got the opportunity through Squawk to do some work. And I worked for Bencrete, I think, first, kind of building climbing walls. And then since then, you know, I did quite a long time of building climbing walls. So I could kind of work for a month and then have a month off or work for 2 months. And it just meant that I was available to go climbing. But I just kind of fell into that. That was just, again, from opportunities coming and saying yes to them, you know. Squawk at some point was like, we need some labourers. Are you interested? So it kind of snowballed, I suppose. And then by the time I was in my, I suppose, early 20s, all my mates back home had like jobs and cars and stuff like that. And I kind of was sofa surfing, living out of a bag, you know, spending a lot of time going away, climbing. I kind of got, I got into traveling a lot. One of my, a really good mate called Andy Long, he was a bit older than me. He is a bit older than me. And he was just going out and doing stuff. So he'd go to Spain for a week on peanuts when Ryanair was, they were like train tickets. And I just got in this cycle of, just going climbing, doing a bit of work and hanging out.
I was going to ask you about that kind of desire to travel or starting traveling, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of your generation of climbers, like the really young guns coming through now, it's super normal to sort of chase the weather and the seasons. Was that the case when you were in your early 20s, or was that a rarer thing that you were doing?
I think it was probably a bit rarer. Yeah, I don't think, you know, people would go to Spain for like, you know, it was like the Costa Blanca and those early Montaneros and those early places. But people would go for, you know, you might go for a week, 2 weeks, and that was a year. Whereas Andy used to, like, we'd work for like a month and then we'd go to like Spain for a week and then we might go to America for 2 weeks. You know, fly drives in America, we used to fly to Vegas, get a hire car, and it was about, I don't know, like 250 quid each. Fly and hire a car, and then we'd sleep in ditches and just go cracking. And we, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and I used to do that quite a lot, you know, like, I didn't spend half my time not in the country, but I kind of snowballed, you know, to more than a third of the year, you know, between a third and half of the year, I would be away somewhere. And then I probably could get away with building climbing walls. There's always been a bit of a boom in it. It was quite lucrative in a lot of ways. And I could earn enough money. I didn't pay rent anywhere. I didn't have a car. I was put up in hotels when I was working. So I'd work for a bit and then I might spend a couple of weeks, you know, in grit season, I'd like sofa surf, hang out with like Sam Whitaker and Ben Bransby. They all lived in Leeds. I used to sleep on their sofa for like weeks on end and just go climbing on the grit and then go to Spain and then go to America and, yeah, just bum around, basically.
It sounds pretty good.
It was pretty good. It was pretty insane. With hindsight now, it was, you know, amazing. But at the time, it just seemed...
Well, it was all you knew, I suppose.
Yeah.
But like we were saying before about getting good, you know, you were saying you weren't sort of chasing it as an end goal, but you're travelling all the time and I'm guessing that job's quite physical, so you're probably staying quite fit at work.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden it just feels like everything, you know, move after move, day after day, you're just getting fitter, stronger, more exposure to it.
Yeah.
And I, again, we don't know each other very well, and I sense you're going to be really self-deprecating, but you were getting to a level at that point that was, you know, elite.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't ever, I've always climbed with people that have been better than me. And I've always been fine with that. You know, I'm not like, I got reasonably good, you know, like in the early 90s doing E7 on grit, you know, like before hard grit came out, and I, you know, I climbed a lot of E7s with Sam Waycott and kind of cruising around doing that. And you kind of think you're getting pretty good, but then start going to America and you know, like, right, well, I've climbed E7 on grit. Like, so, you know, you're looking at 513s. And then you go and get your ass kicked and you realise that, you know, it's all very niche, but yeah, I kind of, you know, I got pretty good at a certain style of climbing, I suppose. And then when we were in Spain, that was more like mileage. I was never a great red pointer, but it was fun, you know, like, and lots of bouldering. But bouldering was different then as well. You know, they're all so focused now. Like, we used to just... you kind of just went pottering and you didn't project things, or it was, yeah, it was all very different.
More like a rest day activity.
Oh, well, not a rest day activity, but there was very little kind of strategy or like, you know, like, right, I'm going to try this problem and I want to do this problem. So I'm solely going to try this problem today. You know, you'd have a few goals and then you'd go on to the next one. And we kind of did circuits like they do, you know, like old school fun, and you just cruise around and do the circuit. And I mean, in lots of ways, a lot of people were very capable of doing lots of things that didn't get done till later, but we just didn't have those kind of eyes. We didn't notice that, you know, you weren't looking for new boulder problems. You just did the old boulder problems. And it was more about, you know, at the time, it was more about doing roots.
And when did you start big walling and getting into the bigger stuff?
Well, so me and Long Air were going to America quite a lot. So I got into multi-pitching and doing, you know, some of the bigger routes over there. So like the Needles, Red Rocks, places like that. And then I met Leo and I think I'd been to Yosemite the year before, and he'd been and done El Nino with Patch. And I met Leo and we kind of got on. And he was like, I mean, I was just, one of my things, I was always just available. So he was obviously looking for somebody, you know, that he knew to do stuff. So he, you know, at one point he was like, you know, maybe we spent a lot of time partying together. And at one point we came to the conclusion, you know, well, maybe we should go climbing, as that's the kind of thing that in theory we are. So we kind of arranged to meet up in Yosemite. And, you know, by that time did I have an American girlfriend? I can't remember. At some point I ended up with an American girlfriend. So I was over there quite a lot. And then that kind of snowballed. So Leo was going through his Yosemite phase and he wanted to be in Yosemite all the time. And I was in America quite a lot. So I just started going to the Valley. And yeah, it was like a really amazing time in the Valley. I think everybody's time in the Valley is amazing. And you've always got like rose-tinted glasses for your sort of your era. But it was a really special time, again, with loads of like amazing characters. And I really, you know, there was a while where I really felt like part of it. You know, I was there before a lot of people arrived. I was still there when everybody left. You know, I was kind of like a local, you know, there were people like Dean Fiedelman and Micah once, he was like, Pickles, he's more of a local than me, you know, because I was there when he got there and I was still there when he left. And, you know, people were going, we'd be there in the fall, there in the spring. It's criminal, really, how little we did, considering how much time we spent there. But yeah, so got into kind of, you know, the big wall in there, and it was all kind of big wall party style. which meant going heavy and try to free things. But then that kind of leads itself to expeditions that came later on where, you know, we were pulling 300 kilos up the wall, wasn't totally alien. You know, we used to haul kegs and like take barbecues, and, you know, we once had like a cool box on Lady Ledge with like ice cream and cocktails. And
but that's one of the things that I find so attractive about it all. You know, I've never been a good climber and I never will be. But I think when I read the stories and listen to the stories of like your guys' era and your guys' time there, you know, I have huge respect for the people that are going there now and getting stuff done so fast, and it's all very sporty.
Yeah.
But I like that whole era of we had ice cream on ledges and we were partying hard. And
yeah, you know, it's, again, characters. It was really like, you know, you could get away with being a good climber without actually having to train like an Olympic athlete. Whereas like nowadays, the standards and the levels are just insane. And it must be insanely boring. Whereas we were just having fun. I mean, in a way, it's a little, I do, it's a shame we weren't a little bit more focused. With a little bit more effort, we could have achieved or done a lot more. But then it's never been about doing stuff. For me, it's always been about fun, you know. Like Leo and various other people that I climbed with, you know, that doing things was important to them. Whereas, you know, sometimes it pisses me off that I wasn't more focused or driven, but ultimately I wasn't, and I wasn't bothered, you know. So we'd get somewhere and there'd be a hard pitch and Leo or somebody like Ben Bransbett, you know, they'd do it. And it's like, right, well, I'm not as good as you. It's going to take, if I'm going to do this, it's going to take like another 2 or 3 days. So it was more about having fun for me.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But in a sense, again, you're correct.
Which again is a good thing and a bad thing. And you know, when I look back, you know, I've freed enough, more than enough pitches on El Cap to have done a free route, but I've never free climbed El Cap, you know, which is nuts. I've probably freed enough pitches on El Cap to have climbed like 203, but I've never done a full route, which, yeah, you know, in some ways is a bit irritating, but in some ways it's like, well, yeah, but we had so much fun. And like, would I, you know, you see people like projecting things and people who spent whole seasons, you know, just working on our pitch, on our room. Whereas, yeah, it was never that important to me. So,
but is that maybe why people like you and Leo got on so well? Because
100%, it was like a kind of symbiotic relationship where, I was just psyched on being there and having fun and happy to go and do what other people wanted to do and what their, you know, what, I suppose I'm like an energy vampire or like, you know, you want to go and try that? Yeah, I'm like mad for it. Let's go there. It'd be amazing. But then go up there and then be like, no, I'm not bothered about that pitch. Like, you know, maybe I could do it, but like, let's just keep going. So we worked extremely well together. And we, you know, more than all of that, I mean, and a lot of that came, we just got on and always have got on really, really well. You know, we're really, really good friends and we know each other. And always kind of have connected, I think, quite quite well. So, yeah, so we, yeah, it was just a lot of fun, really, and not about numbers and things. I've not read his book, I'll be honest. I've flicked through and read the bits that are relevant in some way, either where I mentioned or times that I knew about. And I've probably read most of it, but not from start to finish. But I was talking to my oldest about it the other day, and he writes in the book, which I'd not kind of clocked, even though I had read that bit before. We got caught in a storm one time on the top, and it was, I think, for both of us, the thing that I'd not clocked were he kind of says that it's one of the times where all of a sudden he was like, we got proper schooled and we got really worked. And he was like, that was kind of fun. And like, I liked that and I can do it. And I liked being scared and, you know, it was very similar for me. It was nowhere near to the degree that it is for Leo. You know, he doesn't get scared and we're very different in lots of ways. But after that, we got worked super hard, and it's kind of like strength through adversity. Once you've been through something really grim, you've got the confidence of knowing, you know, I can do this. And then that kind of releases you. You're like, oh, well, I'm not scared about having to spend the whole night outside anymore. You know, like, don't get me wrong, I don't want to do it. And it was grim, but I think we both kind of developed this confidence. I mean, me obviously to a much lesser degree than Leo, but it was like a real thing. And it's one of the things where I think for both of us, we bonded a lot that night as well. It was like, it was pretty full on, and we went through something pretty extreme together, and we both kind of got a lot from it. And then that kind of went off on lots of, yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah, because I don't know if that was one of the trigger points, but then obviously you went on to do all sorts of amazing things around the world on, you know, proper, hardcore, adventurous big wall expeditions, first ascents. Not necessarily like before it was being done by loads of other people, but at a time where it was much rarer.
Yeah.
And I think like, you know, again, essentially being honest but self-deprecating when you say all that, but like, it seems to me, you know, he didn't invite you just because he liked you. He invited you because you were a sure thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it feels like if he's the captain, you're the sergeant, he just knows you'll just crack on.
Yeah, I mean, he's a born leader, ultimately. And like, I'm a born second, you know, like, tell me to go over the top and I'll go over the top. Like, and I genuinely would. I would go anywhere with him. I would follow him anywhere.
Yeah, I know what that feels like.
I trust his judgment more than I trust my own judgment. He know, you know, his judgment of levels and of other people's levels is, you know, of my level is better than my own judgment. I get clouded by either self-doubt or fear. Leo manages to not let his judgment be clouded by things like that. He takes everything from an open, basic point, and it's not clouded by being scared and invariably he's right, which can be quite irritating.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But he is, you know, and I'm into being told, well, you know, tell me what to do. Don't ask me to make the decisions. I'm not, you know, I'm all right with that and I can do that, but my natural inclination is to do what I'm told by somebody that I trust.
Yeah.
And so me and Leo had a very good relationship in that sense.
But that's like, this isn't a self-help podcast, but that's like expert team selection in a way. Like, you don't want to pick four other leaders.
And no, I think like, no, exactly.
I've been in loads of situations with him where Because I, you know, what you were just saying, he's not reckless. That's what's amazing.
No. Not in the slightest.
He's generally always right, and it is kind of irritating. Yeah, I think you have to sort of be there to understand that.
Yeah. You know, like, right, it's, we can just solo up there.
Yeah.
What? Really? Well, like, we're, you know, we're 300 metres up some face somewhere, it does look easy, but so, you know, like, really? But he's right, you know, like, you're three times faster, and it is, you know, like, what you've, you know, I think never try and second guess him, really. I hope you don't listen to this, because...
No, I know, like, me neither.
Yeah, but, you know, like, you know, genuinely,
I mean,
he's not reckless in the slightest, is he?
No, and I sort of started hanging out with him, going on trips with him at very formative, like I was 24, 25, and I was just getting into the game properly. And he gave me my first proper big break. And like, I now lead teams for a living, right? That's my job on the ground. And I think about this so often, like I have become the professional I am. If I look at all the people who've molded me in any ways, you know, he's a complete outlier. Like, I don't know anybody else like him. I don't know any other leaders like him. And like, I've definitely modelled and taken a lot of what I saw when he was leading me into how I lead other people.
Yes.
Yeah. It's quite something. And I don't know if you could explain it fully unless you've seen it.
Yeah.
The idea that he goes, it's going to take 3.5 hours. That bit's going to be really hard. You're carrying too much weight. And when most people say you're carrying too much weight, I go, no, I'll be all right. When Leo says you're carrying too much weight, I say, okay, Leo, how much should I take out my bag? Or he says, you need to carry 3 more. I'm like, okay, give me 3 more kilos.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, of course, sir. Off we go, sir. It's very strange.
Yeah.
So, end of the fanboy speech. Tell me about Asgard and how it came about and what it was like for you.
Asgard's the hardest expedition I've ever been on, for sure. We were green, basically. We were like, we were out there, and we were like, we were way above our pay grade in a lot of ways. It was. How did it come about? I don't even know how it came about. Like, I can just remember Leo saying, "Check this out. Do you fancy this?" To which, as usual, I replied, "Yeah, sounds great." I vividly remember being in Pang and like sorting through all our gear, and there were two Canadian guys. One, I can't remember what they were both called, but one of them is a guy called John Walsh, who's like a crusher, hardcore, super seasoned, and they were just coming out. And I can remember like feeling so green and just like looking at them and being like they look like, you know, hardcore animals, and like, what are we doing here? Like, holy shit, oh no. You know, what have we got into? And then we went in and we got committed. And I mean, it was really, really hard, but it was really, really fun as well the whole time. Don't look back, I'm really good at, I don't remember the bad bits. I like rose tint everything afterwards, and loads of it was hard, but I don't remember those bits really. I just remember it as being like fun. Check out where we are. Like, this was insane. It was hard. It was super cold. I had these boots that were maybe, I wouldn't say they were too small. Well, no, they were too small, but my feet weren't crunched up in them, but you kind of, in mountain boots, you kind of want a bit of air circulating. And I got cold feet. And from when we got on the wall, I didn't feel my feet for about 3 months afterwards. I kind of got like, I think I got frostnip when we came back. I ended up going to the doctors and they were like, frostnip, it will come back. I mean, when we came out, we went to, can't remember what the capital's called now, but the capital of Baffin. Baffin's dry. So in the capital, you can drink and there are bars, but they're really strict about letting people in and out. And as my feet started to warm up, they kind of started to warm up on the walk out. They kind of like, I was struggling to walk. They got all swollen. And so I was walking around like a bit of a mong, and basically they wouldn't let me in this bar. They were like, no, you've had too much, because there's a real drink problem there. Anybody who's showing any signs of being drunk, you just don't get let in. And I was mortified. I was literally like, we've been in the wilderness for like 2.5 months. What do you mean I can't come in? I'm like, I'm not drunk. I can't walk. Like, I literally like pleading. And they were just like, no, you're not coming in.
What did you do?
I went home. Stanley, to be fair, Stanley came back with me. We'd had a few, you know, we'd had a few beers, but nowhere near as many as I wanted. Yeah.
What did that lead on to, that trip, and how did it change you all?
Again, a bit like the epic on El Cap with Leo in the storm. I think, again, like, strength through adversity. There's an amazing, have you seen Tommy's TED Talk?
No.
Tommy does a TED Talk that's amazing, that's about like strength through adversity. And that, you know, like, it's probably like people who go to war, or, I mean, you come back different. And, you know, for me, came back feeling like I could deal with pretty much anything. You know, like, I can suffer. I can, you know, like, if you put your mind to it. And I think most people in everyday life have got no idea what they can do. And it's not that any of us are superheroes. It's just that we ended up, through either saying yes or through circumstance, you end up finding out something of what you can do. And that gives you like a confidence or a swagger or a need to want to do more of it. And, you know, it gets addictive. It's like, you know, I need to feel that jeopardy and that kind of, again, like I was saying about not worrying, I like, it's so straightforward when you're on a trip. There's just nothing else to, it's like end goal. Like, you know, I'm all I've got to do today is carry that bag from here to there. And the simplicity of that, I like it.
It's addictive.
And yeah, and it's going to be hard, but I'm kind of mad for it. And yeah, and it just kind of, that trip just took us another notch, I think. And it was just like, right, you know, and how I felt going in, looking at John Walsh, and then coming out, I was like, you know, I am John Walsh. Like, you know, like, we can do this. Like, you know, that was grim, but that's what you can do when you put your mind to it and you all work together. And not only all that, I found it massively fun. All those trips, all that, I've never once been like, I don't want to be here. Even when it's like really, really grim. Even when I, you know, hobbling out, having not felt my feet for like 10 days, I wasn't ever like, oh God, I wish I'd not come on this. It was always just like, that was so much fun.
Yeah.
So that led to more of the same, in a way. Obviously, Al made the film, and then that just kind of snowballed for all of us, you know, and Leo was like, right, you know what he's like, he's pre-driven and like, right, this just opens up more doors. And then he was always like, you know, do you want to come? And I was like, yeah.
But it's such a unique position, particularly for somebody like you, because, you know, he's got his sponsorship and he's got his expedition fund as part of that deal, and Al's making the movies. Like, those trips, when you think about Antarctica or Asgard first time, like, they're expensive for normal human beings. And you were just getting a ticket to go.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And that is an amazing, like, unique opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's what, you know, I mean, in lots of ways, without ever thinking about it, I made so that was possible by, you know, the nature of the work that I did and whatever, I can just drop everything and go. And I kind of, I think maybe subconsciously, did that rather than it being a conscious thing. And like, I was just, you know, like, right, if these opportunities come up, then I want to be able to go. And you know, the films and all the rest of it, they were, you know, some of the most expensive Audi, you know, like Antarctica is like the most expensive Audi anybody could ever go on.
Yeah.
You know, it was insane. But at the same time, you know, like, we all brought something to the table, you know, we all worked hard for those things.
Did you ever, go on, sorry.
Yeah, like, getting Al off Asgard, you know, off the top of Asgard, again, like, I mean, it's going back to what we were talking about before, I suppose, but that was like a very formative thing for me in a way. That was the reason that I was there in a lot of ways. But then to actually like do that and execute it and like watch them two, you know, I'm up here with my mates and two of them are like the most accomplished big wall free climbers in the world. And now they're going to jump off and leave me up here.
With a film director.
With a film director and another guy who's like super inexperienced. And we're going to get down and get off.
But you did.
And we did, yeah. Yeah, fortunately.
Are you ever bothered by, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, I'm sure you won't, but like playing second fiddle to Leo, no. Essentially?
No, not at all. Like, I'm not playing second, you know, like, if anything, like, playing second fiddle to Leo is better, higher achievement than me. Do you know what I mean? You know, like, you know, if you want to look at it like that. I mean, I'm not bothered by that shit, really. It's fun. And it sounds like a cliche and I sound like a bit of a twat saying it, but it's always been about having fun and I've had a huge amount of fun and I'm not bothered. I'm pretty secure in a lot of ways. Everybody's got an ego, but I don't have a huge, I don't feel the need to, I kind of don't care what people think about. I mean, I do, but you know what I mean?
Like what the right people think
I'm
about
not,
you.
Yeah, I'm not bothered. You know, really.
It's interesting, there's parallels in a way, because like, some people say to me, oh, does it ever bother you that you make all these movies, but you're not in them and no one knows you exist? I'm like, no. Like, you need to understand that people like me don't do things like this. Cameras are my ticket to go big walling with Leo Holding. Like, yeah. And that was, now that's become normal. I can say that without it feeling weird. Like, I do things like that all the time. It's my ticket to go and hang out with Leo, Alex Honnold, all these people. That's my ticket. I don't need the fame, fortune and glory. A bit of fortune would be nice maybe one day.
Yeah.
The fame obviously. And the glory, I can do with that.
Yeah.
But I think some people get a bit obsessed with the need to become famous or have everybody think they're brilliant for doing this stuff, but you don't.
No, I don't, genuinely.
So it's a tangent, but I really wanted to talk about this and you probably guessed I would. Because I'm often messaging you about when my children are going to be old enough that I can have a life again. But your life is now radically different from the one you've described in this podcast so far. When did it change? How did it change? And what's your life like now?
So my wife has her own business. She works like super hard. She works a lot. And the only way we were going to have kids was if I was going to do the meat of bringing them up, so to speak. So we decided to have kids. I'd always wanted to have kids. We had kids. My wife, she went days out, she went back to work. Literally, she was back in work a week, 2 weeks after giving birth. She breastfed for a year. I used to meet her in car parks in between meetings because that was the only way, you know, if we were going to have kids, that was the only way it was going to happen, really. And again, like about me not worrying, just deal with what's in front of you. And if I'd actually sat down and thought about the implications of it all, I would have probably gone like, why on earth would I do that? No, that sounds shit. But I didn't. And don't get me wrong, again, you know, thinking about it coming down, I thought, you know, I knew you'd ask about this. And again, the whole rose-tinted thing, it was actually quite hard. And I only kind of came to that conclusion on the way down in a lot of ways. There were times where it was pretty hard for me. from like an identity point of view. I kind of, for a long time, I didn't really have a lot of interaction with other adults or other people. I went from like hanging out with my mates in the middle of nowhere or banter at work to being me and a small kid in a house. You know, my wife was working 50, 60, 70 hours a week and having identified as a climber and being defined by that for a long time. I didn't have, you know, I was like, you know, who am I? What am I? And it was pretty tough for a bit.
Given that you know I'm living through it right now, my wife's on stage 8 times a week. How long? Just exactly? Just so I can...
Well, you know, like it slowly just starts to come back, doesn't it? You know, like we've now got 2 kids. My youngest is 5. And I feel like the last few years I've started to get my life back a little bit. You know, I've just got back from going on a trip with Leo. It was only a short trip, but, it does come back and you do kind of, you can like reconnect with who you are or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. At risk of, I'm not trying to deliberately kind of be all progressive in 2024 about it, but how did, you know, we can gloss over the fact that you were once voted Britain's manliest man. and that's a fact. To becoming the stay-at-home dad while your wife was the breadwinner, like, did that ever bash your ego or was that always okay?
No, not really. No, like, no, again, like the whole climbing, you know, no, not, it's not anything that I've ever thought. The biggest trouble for a little bit, you know, like the whole identity thing and what am I, who am I, what is, you know, and just being the primary carer for a small baby 24/7, you know, it is hard. And doing it as a bloke in some ways doing it as a bloke is harder because women, you know, I didn't go to, there's all these like women's groups.
NCT groups.
Yeah, he's the weirdo. So, you know, like, I did a little bit, you know, like,
I totally,
it's just
know
like,
what you
mean. I don't, you know, I don't fit in. I'm not, yeah, like, this is not for me.
Yeah.
So I was kind of quite alone for a while. But whether you're a man, boy, you know, whatever, it's irrelevant, isn't it? I genuinely don't look at it like that. And I think for a little bit I maybe did, you know, doubt the whole masculinity sort of thing. It is a little bit emasculate, you know, maybe it was for a little, you know, there were definite, I suppose I'd be lying if I didn't say I felt that a little bit, but in general, not really at all. And like now, like, you know, that was in the deepest, darkest when it's really hard and you're proper on the coal face. I maybe did feel a little bit emasculated or whatever the term is. Whereas now, you know, I mean, I feel like I'm lucky to have been able to do that with my kids. And most blokes don't get to do that. And don't, you know, it's been an amazing thing. And, it, you know, don't get me wrong, it's been pretty hard at times, but it's also been like a massive pleasure.
It is good to hear because you said something similar to me at Kendall Festival last year and I needed to hear it at the time because I was starting to get into this headspace of like, oh, I've got to look after the kids. It was like this job I had. And I can't remember exactly what you said, but your point was basically like, this is going to go really fast and then it's going to be different and it's going to be gone. Like, enjoy it.
Yeah.
It is fun if you make it fun.
Yeah.
And I have changed my attitude and it's really made a difference. Like when the baby wakes up at 8 p.m. and I'm trying to do something with my only hours of the day, I'm like, no, I need to go and look after this little boy. And that's not going to be, he's not going to be a tiny baby for much longer.
Yeah.
Probably a couple of months.
Yeah.
Then it's gone.
Yeah. And it is really rewarded. Do you know what I mean? Like, it genuinely is.
particularly now the kids, what, they're 5 and 7? Or
mine are 5 and 9.
5 and 9. Well, now I'm guessing the 9-year-old's now asking about all the stuff you've done and is interested. And
yeah, yeah, well, exactly. He's reading Leo's book at the moment.
Is, whoops.
Yeah.
Does he think it's cool? Or normal?
I don't. Who knows? You know, I don't know. I think, and I don't know whether he thinks it's cool just because I did it, or whether he thinks it's cool genuinely because he thinks it's cool.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like the whole we did a. You know, just and doing stuff with them. You know, we did a trip. Like we went and tried to climb Triglav in the summer as like a family. You can do like a hut to hut, and there's sort of Via Ferratas. And we got stormed on. We got like caught in a really, really quite bad storm. I mean, even I'd give it like a low 7 on my scale, and like, you know, you don't survive 10, and like, you know, it was pretty grim, and I was a little bit worried that it had traumatized him. You know, we got caught out, and it was like, it blew me over, the wind. So, you know, I was holding the kids down. It was raining. It got cold. Everybody got wet. There was lightning. We were on a Via Ferrata. It was pretty full on. And I was a bit worried that I'd traumatized him. But then again, that whole strength through adversity thing afterwards, you know, like my youngest now, a couple of times he's been like, this is fine. I've been up Triglav. And it's so rewarding doing that sort of stuff with him and try to pass that on to him. And I think they do sponge it up. So I think, I hope he thinks it's cool, because it is cool, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, how could it not be cool going up, you know, like...
climbing mountains.
Yeah, and just, like, extreme camping. You know, that's big wall. And hanging out with your mates, doing ludicrous things in, like, ludicrous places. And what could not be cool about that?
Yeah. It's kind of a nice place to leave it. I always ask the same two questions at the end of every episode. You're going to hate them. The first is, what scares you?
In one sense, nothing. Having been through various things, and like, there's a whole other podcast here, the whole Yopo thing. I've been to hell and back, and you know, I was stuck in hell for eternity. So nothing could ever be. It couldn't ever be any worse than what I went through in that, in one sense. So in one sense, you know, like, I don't worry about stuff. You know, I'm not like, so I'm not scared of, I'm not really scared of anything in one sense. But then in the short term, you know, I've just been away with Leo for a week. I spent half of that time mildly scared. You know, like...
You seem to like being a bit scared.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun, isn't it? You know, like... But, yeah, Leo scares me sometimes. but in a good way.
What brings you hope?
My kids. 100%, you know. The world is kind of fucked up at the moment, and that's on us. And I hope that our kids can learn from the mess we've made and sort it out a little bit. But hopefully we're equipping them well enough and that they can do that. And I think, you know, they can, I hope.
Amazing. I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
All right, sure.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.